Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Anastasia Bowden for Appellant Creighton Meland. SB 826, or the woman quota, was enacted on the theory that shareholder elections were not producing the state's preferred number of female board members. It therefore sought to change shareholder behavior at annual elections. If the law does not change shareholder behavior, it does not effectuate its goals. The state now says that even though it has enshrined into law a minimum number of women board members, the people responsible for effectuating that quota don't have standing to sue. The right to vote for board members is one of the most important contractual rights that shareholders have as owners of the company. And given the existence of the 14th Amendment, it includes the right to vote free of a government-imposed sex-based mandate. Creighton Meland, as a shareholder, has standing to challenge SB 826. Importantly, Meland will be injured at every election, regardless of how he behaves. If he complies, he suffers an injury because he's been forced to vote based on immutable characteristics, and that is an Article 3 injury.
Let me ask you, he's not forced to vote for anyone. He can vote for whomever he wants, can't he?
The law attaches a penalty to his choice, Your Honor, and so it is attempting to coerce him into doing as the quota says. And there are several other cases.
Well, I'm having trouble with how it attaches a penalty to his vote.
It doesn't attach a penalty to him. It attaches a penalty to the third party. It's essentially
a corporation.
That's right, Your Honor.
So the corporation could sue here. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. The corporation could sue for its own injuries, including a potential penalty.
Now, what is the corporation's injury? So the corporation doesn't have any control over the shareholders. So how is it injured by the state law?
You're right, Judge Okuda, that the corporation is a passive actor in this, although it may be able to sue for any injuries it would suffer, like a potential penalty or anything else that it says that it has suffered. But here, we're not alleging that type of injury. We're alleging a completely separate injury, and that is an injury to our shareholder voting rights. And we think, you know, we incur that injury regardless of whether the corporation suffers an injury, regardless of whether the corporation is ever penalized. At every single election, Creighton Meland will suffer an injury because he's subject to the sex-based mandate.
So you defined a couple of injuries in your reply brief, but they weren't even mentioned before, having to do the quota making it more difficult to invest, and also he's at a disadvantage. And I'm not sure we should really address those because they weren't even raised until your reply brief. So I'm just really trying to crystallize in my mind, what is the injury that he alleges?
His injury is being subject to a sex-based quota. And our argument regarding his vote being put at a disadvantage, I think, is a fair inference from our allegations. It's plain on the face of the law, and it's a fair inference from our argument. That is, we've argued that he is being coerced by the state to vote a certain way.
But how is he being coerced by the state to vote a certain way? I mean, that's where I hear what you're saying, and he hasn't actually alleged in his complaint, you know, allegations of this nature in terms of he's changing his vote and that sort of thing. So we've got the corporation over here, and then you've got him, but I don't see how he is subject to a quota vote. That's what the link I'm missing.
Sure, Your Honor. The law is phrased in the passive voice. It just says that a certain number of women must be elected. Now, shareholders are responsible for doing the electing. And just because the state has chosen to punish a third party for any infractions does not mean that the law is not regulating shareholders. There are plenty of cases where the law is not explicitly directed at the regulated party, but as a matter of common sense, it operates on those parties. So we can take, for example, example, the Duarte case out of the Fifth Circuit, which said that families of sex offenders have standing to challenge laws that regulate where sex offenders live, because the practical consequence is also to regulate where the family members live. Or out of this circuit, we have RK Ventures, in which this court said that shareholders of a club could challenge a law that regulated which music the club played, because the practical effect was to affect the shareholders, because the shareholders in that case were the ones who chose which music to play.
But I keep coming back to this conclusion. Those are very specific allegations and impact and injury. So here I'm looking for something more than the conclusory allegation that says he can't vote for the director of his choice.
The injury is being pressured. It's changing the dynamic of the election and favoring votes in favor of women. Now, even if he flouts the quota, even if anyone flouts the quota, they're still injured, because their no vote is being put at a disadvantage. It's this coercive pressure. It's the scheme in which certain votes
are not a no vote. I mean, first of all, he's not challenged the fact that the governance committee or some other body is actually doing the nominating, right? He hasn't challenged that.
No, Your Honor, because that would be, they could raise their own injury, but his injury is when it comes to the ultimate vote.
Right. But he hasn't said that he's, I don't see any allegation that says he's forced to vote for a woman, or that he feels out of fear, out of falling out of compliance with the statute, that he's forced to vote for a woman. It just seems to me those kind of allegations, which you're now talking about, I'm not seeing those in the complaint.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's important to note that this case was...
So tell me what section of the complaint I would look to.
Sure. Well, if I can give some background, which is that this was a case...
Well, what I'd like to do...
Sure.
Is I'm asking a very specific question, and you're making very general arguments. And I understand your argument completely, but I'm trying to cross-reference it with...
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I have the complaint in front of me, and I would say that the allegations following plaintiff's injury, such as paragraph 22, which say that the woman quota is designed to compel the election of more females onto corporate boards, and in order to achieve its goal, the law must impact the behavior of shareholders like Mr. Meland, who are responsible for doing the voting. And if we go down just a little bit, we say, of course, that he intends to vote, and that the quota injures his right to vote for the candidate of his choice, free from the threat that the corporation will be fined. And I think this is a case similar to some of these contracting cases that have come out of the Ninth Circuit and the Supreme Court, where the injury is not the denial of any certain outcome. It's not that his preferred candidate won't be elected. It's being subject to a system in which decisions that preference immutable characteristics are favored. And
I understand, I mean, those contracting cases are very direct in terms of what's going to happen with the contractors. It's a very different situation. What do you think is the closest case that supports your argument with respect to standing?
I would point to three cases. This is a very unique law, and I do want to add that this case was brought as a pre-enforcement case seeking prospective relief, and that's why the allegations are more general. And we do believe that he's injured no matter how he votes. But in terms of which cases are best for us, again, I think it's RK Ventures, where the law is only operating on the club, but practically speaking, it impacts the decisions of the shareholders. Also, the Duarte case that I mentioned out of the circuit, where there was no penalty at all to the family members. The family members were free to move wherever they wanted. But as a practical matter, it was impacting their freedom to move where they wanted, because they wanted to live with their family member who was regulated by the regulation. And lastly, I would point to Owner-Operator Independent Truckers Association out of the Seventh Circuit, in which the compliance with the law at issue there, which regulated rest hours for individual truckers, it was measured at the carrier level. and yet the individual operators had standing to bring suit because the court recognized that ultimately it was their behavior that the statute was trying to influence. Here we know that the statute is trying to influence shareholder behavior. It's trying to get them to vote in a certain way. And even if they don't conform to the state's preferred behavior, they suffer an injury because they've been put at a disadvantage. That's just inherent in the nature of this law, that one type of vote is privileged and the other isn't. And so I think those three cases really highlight
that. Of course, part of the assumption behind that is that he's not going to vote for a female candidate, and he hasn't alleged that. So I don't see that one vote is privileged over the other. In the end, they all get added up.
It's privilege in the sense that the state has attached a consequence to one type of vote and no legal consequence to the other. He hasn't alleged that he would vote for any one candidate because that may change from election to election. But again, any way you cut it, he's going to be injured, because if he votes for the woman against his will in compliance with the quota because he fears the potential legal consequence, he's been forced to vote on immutable characteristics. If he flouts the quota, his vote is at a disadvantage. Even if he votes for a woman.
You know, I mean, that I'm having trouble with, why it's a disadvantage. He votes for whoever he wants to. The statute doesn't do anything. And the question is, the proof is in the pudding. How does it turn out? He's not a majority shareholder. He doesn't hold some disproportionate situation where he's going to tilt the vote. He's a single vote that will be added up. And of course, we don't know the result. And we also don't know what his predilection is. Maybe he wants to vote for the most qualified candidate. That could be a woman, might not be a woman, but not everybody's going to be a female or a male necessarily in the outcome. So that's where it's this kind of speculative clapper type injury that is giving me some pause in your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I think now I'm seeing the disconnect. The reason we would say that the reason he's put at a disadvantage is because we have alleged that the law has a coercive effect. So even if Mr. Meehlin chooses to flout the quota, it's a fair inference that the law is having a coercive effect on other shareholders, which means that it is thwarting the election. It's putting the state's power behind.
This isn't a class action. It's not a derivative suit. It's you know, it's a single shareholder, correct?
That's right, Your Honor. And I didn't mean to suggest that we're saying that we have some sort of injury because of the coercion. It's coercion exercised on other people that is our injury. It's the consequence of that, which is that our vote now has essentially been thwarted. In a free election, all votes would have been put on equal footing and people would have voted their conscience. And now we have a law that is coercing various people and it's putting his vote, again, on an unequal playing field. I mean, perhaps that's a better way of putting it. That was the way that the court put it in Northeastern Florida chapter of Associated General Contractors, is that the injury is being on an unequal playing field when it comes to equal protection.
I'm not sure I understand this. Are you saying that assuming that he would vote for the best candidate, he's disadvantaged because other people would vote to comply with the law requiring a woman? Or what exactly are you saying here?
Your Honor, it's to say that the state has suggested that he's completely free to flout the quota if he believes that's the best candidate for the job. And so he's therefore not injured. He can vote however he wants. And our response is to say, even if he does vote how he wants and that does flout the quota, he's still injured because presumably everybody else, some people are being coerced by the law, and that is tilting the election in favor of certain candidates. And I think if we look at how the law has played out, it's very difficult for the government to contend that the law isn't having some sort of coercive effect, because since the law has gone into effect, Hundreds of women have been elected to corporate boards. And so that supports the allegation that this is coercive and interfering with shareholder voting rights. And certainly Delaware courts have recognized that any sort of interference with shareholder voting rights is a direct...
Of course, you know, that actually begs the question, because we all know the reality is they were never nominated. So if you're not nominated, you can't even be voted on. Oh. And so he's not challenging, as I understand, what is really the precursor process in every board, and that is the governance committee decides who's going to be on our slate this year. So he's not challenging that. Am I correct?
No, Your Honor, because whoever ends up being nominated, it's shareholders who have the ultimate responsibility to...
Right. But I just want to be clear. The answer to my question is he's not challenging the corporation's authority or whatever decisions they make or it makes with respect to who's nominated.
That's correct, Your Honor, because whatever effect it's having on the nomination committee, even if most of the work was going on at that level, that's where it was playing out, he would still ultimately, like all shareholders, have a responsibility to either confirm or reject that nominee.
Let me just, to make sure I understand this, you're saying that because the state law encourages shareholders to discriminate based on immutable characteristics, every individual shareholder has this, either they're being encouraged to discriminate, or if they don't discriminate, their vote is unequal because of this overall effect. Is that what you're saying? Am I understanding this correctly?
Well, certainly, I think Delaware courts have interpreted shareholder standing very expansively, because any interference with the right to elect board members is an injury, regardless of whether that action ends up effectuating its goals or not. And here, there's the added dynamic that there's this equal protection problem, and that it's just inherent in equal protection jurisprudence that standing is pretty broad. People have standing even if they would have discriminated in the first place to challenge mandatory discrimination. As the court found in the Peterson case, or as this court found in Monterey Mechanical, even if you would have done that action anyway, if there's a state mandate to do it, you have standing, because we know that sex and race-based classifications are so odious. To point out another way that it's expansive, even if you...
I just wanted to mention, it's up to you, but you have about 3 minutes left, and I didn't know if you wanted to spend it now or later.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that, and I will reserve the rest of my time.
All right. You may proceed.
Good morning. I'm just waiting for the timer to set, if that's all right. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Good morning. Laura Haddad on behalf of Secretary of State. A threshold requirement for any challenge to a statute in federal court is subject matter jurisdiction. Here, Mr. Milland cannot meet the fundamental requirement of Article III standing because he has not shown that he has suffered an injury in fact. Mr. Milland seeks to expand Article III standing as it is applied in the Ninth Circuit to include injuries that do not meet the basic requirements of an invasion of a legally protected interest, which is concrete and particularized, and actual or imminent. Even if Mr. Milland could allege an injury in fact under Article III, which he has not done so here, he also lacks standing as a shareholder under prudential considerations. He cannot show that he has suffered an injury or will suffer an injury that is separate and apart from any injury to OSI Systems, the corporation for which he is a shareholder, and any injury that OSI Systems may suffer.
Well, isn't he is alleging a different injury. OSI Systems doesn't have the voting right. He is the one who has that right. So that does seem different.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Milland has the right to vote for, as a shareholder, has the right to vote his shares for any director, but the alleged injury, especially as alleged in his complaint, which is that he may subject OSI Systems to a fine, any injury accrues to OSI Systems alone.
Doesn't it depend on how we frame his injury? He is not personally fined, but he is arguing that he's being essentially encouraged to vote in a certain way, in this case on the basis of sex or taking sex into account when he doesn't want to do that. So why is that not a sufficient injury?
Because, Your Honor, the injury that he alleges, that if he takes gender into account, OSI Systems will potentially be fined, accrues to OSI Systems alone. It appears that he objects to the mere existence of the law, but just because SB 826 may cause corporations to depend on shareholder votes to be in compliance with the law doesn't mean that it harms those shareholders if a corporation is out of compliance with the law. This is in fact, in particular evidence here with OSI Systems, where their Form 10-K shows for the 2019 election, there were 7 nominees for directors on the board of directors, and all 7 nominees were elected. There wasn't any nominee that Mr. Milland chose not to vote for, and he hasn't alleged that there was a director nominated that he didn't have the opportunity to vote for, or that he wanted someone nominated who wasn't. So in this case, even though, yes, a corporation, in order to be in compliance with SB 826, does rely on the shareholder vote, SB 826 does not regulate shareholders. It doesn't require them to do anything. And if there's any penalty, it doesn't accrue to the shareholder.
It doesn't apply to a corporation. Right? A corporation isn't able to select its own shareholders, and it doesn't really regulate the actions of a corporation. Or am I misunderstanding how the law works?
Your Honor, it's correct that that SB 826 does not, that corporations do not select their own shareholders, but
it's the corporation. It regulates the people who are selecting the board of directors. It just seems very disingenuous to say it doesn't regulate the shareholders, who are the ones who elect the board, which is the focus of the law.
Well, Your Honor, I think SB 826 recognizes that it's the issue is also who is being nominated. And in this case, especially with OSI Systems, the slate of nominees was put forward by the nominating committee, and nominating committees are typically made up of current directors and other corporate members. And for 2019, at any rate, the number of nominees that were put forward are the number of seats that were open. So,
But the law does not regulate who's nominated to the board, to the elections. It regulates who is actually selected to be on the board, and the people who are doing the selection are the shareholders. So I don't really know what the prior process would, the sort of the back end that leads to the election would have to do with this particular plaintiff's claimed injury.
Your Honor, yes, while it is shareholders that choose the director, the harm or the alleged harm does not fall on the shareholders. So while shareholders, while corporations are dependent upon shareholder votes, any harm accrues to the corporation. And that this recognizes.
We're kind of flipping back and forth between Article 3 and Prudential, I realize. But as I understand Ms. Bowden, the harm is that in effect there's a chill over his voting right because of this mandate and the quota. And so why isn't that enough to give him Article 3 standing?
Well, that chill is highly speculative. The evidence of chill is typically, I think, used in, for example, a First Amendment claim. But if this court does consider chill as a factor, there is no evidence that SB 826 chills voter rights here.
Chill may not be the best word. He's saying that this is a cloud or a coercion, an indirect coercion over his ability to vote freely. I think that's what he's saying. Chill was my word.
No, I understand. I think that he has alleged, Mr. Milan personally has alleged no facts to show that he is operating under this this cloud of SB 826, especially because in the current, I think it is worth emphasizing that in 2019, it doesn't appear, he has alleged no facts that a nominee of his choice wasn't put forward, that he voted for one.
That's not his injury, right? His injury is not that somebody he wanted was or was not put forward. His injury is claiming to have to make this decision within a framework of required or encouraged discrimination. That's what he wants. He might well want to vote for a female director, but he doesn't want to do so believing in the system in which there's some legal coercion.
I understand, but I think that is why SB 826 does regulate the corporation, and any harm, or if there's no compliance with SB 826, the corporation is a legally distinct entity that can sue for this harm. I think SB 826 also recognizes, or at least the law recognizes that yes, while shareholders they're the ones that elect the directors, they elect directors to the corporation, which represents all of their interests. So if there is a harm, it is to the corporation. Which can sue to bring its own harm. Regarding whether, can sue to redress any harm that it has.
And is not required to discriminate on the basis of gender. So the corporation.
Can you repeat your question?
I said the corporation is not being required to or encouraged to discriminate on the basis of gender. So that particular injury is not an injury to the corporation. That injury is only to the shareholders. So I'm not understanding why the injury is only or the injury is to the corporation at all. There is no injury to the corporation, at least at present, that I'm aware of. Can you explain that?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I think it goes to the nomination procedure. If there is no, the corporation effectively dictates who the directors are to be put forth to be elected. And again, SB 826 does not require that a shareholder discriminate, doesn't require that a shareholder vote at all.
Shareholders, so the law requires the corporation to have a certain number of women on the board. And you're saying that no shareholder needs to vote to comply with the law. So no shareholder has standing because no shareholder is required to vote to comply with state law. Is that your theory?
No, Your Honor. There is some, we can certainly imagine situations where a shareholder would have standing. If, for example, a shareholder's preferred nominee was not put forward, or if a nominee lost the shareholder, the shareholder wanted to have elected. But here in this case, for the harm that, Mr. Milland has alleged, he does not have standing under this set of facts. Simply because, yes, while corporations are dependent upon shareholders to be in compliance with the law, the harm is to the corporation. If they are not in compliance.
Can you address our line of cases, really starting with Monterey Mechanical, where the point is made that in this context, the injury is requiring or encouraging somebody to discriminate based on a protected characteristic, and why those cases, in your view, don't apply to this situation?
Yes, Your Honor. In Monterey Mechanical in particular, that case involved a state requirement that a general contractor subcontract a specific amount of its work to women or minorities, or demonstrate a good faith effort to do so. The plaintiff there was a general contractor who was denied a bid on a public campus because he met neither of those requirements. This court found that even if the general contractor suffered no discrimination itself, as a condition of granting the general contractor a benefit, the general contractor was not put on equal footing. The general contractor also suffered an injury in fact, because the state exposed him to the risk of liability and because of the increased expense and difficulty in performing a contract. So here, there was an economic harm to the contractor, and there was a harm either way to the contractor. Similarly here, any economic harm would be to the corporation, not to the shareholder. And Mr. Milland has not alleged that he has been denied any form of economic benefit or has been denied investment opportunities such that would qualify for the harm that was at issue in Monterey Mechanical. Regarding RK Ventures, yes, that plaintiffs in that case were shareholders, but they were also principal owners of the corporation, and that case involved an ordinance essentially required their corporation, which was a nightclub, to shut down. Plaintiffs brought suit, and they also, the court there found that they had alleged personal injury for damages. They themselves were harmed because they were prevented from playing the music that they wanted to, and the Ninth Circuit this court didn't differentiate between their status as principal owners and shareholders, really focused on the fact that they were bringing a case for personal injury.
About the shareholder corporation, I was just a little puzzled.
Judge Ikuda, could you maybe get closer to the microphone? Because again, I'm having some trouble hearing.
I'm so sorry. Can you hear me?
That works. Now? Yes.
Okay, so a shareholder, of course, technically has an ownership interest in the corporation. That's what a shareholder means. And we do have cases saying that if there is a financial imposition on the corporation, I'm thinking of Alcan Aluminum here, that the shareholder has standing to challenge a financial imposition on the corporation. I know on RK Ventures, you were distinguishing between being a shareholder and an owner. And so I'm not sure I understand that distinction, and maybe you could address that.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, in cases where there has been the economic ownership has been recognized, it typically does not, for purposes of prudential standing, for shareholder standing, an effect under both Delaware and California law.
Talk about Article 3 standing?
Because
I think Aluminum was an Article 3 standing case.
Yes, Your Honor. So under Article 3 standing, economic harm can be, of course, enough to assert an injury in fact. And in RK Ventures, the economic harm was to... the plaintiffs, they brought a personal injury claim for the shutdown of their business. But here...
threat of a penalty, and I understand the secretary has not yet promulgated regulations to penalize a corporation. So what we have is a threat of a penalty against the corporation. And explain why that's not enough for the shareholders' standing claim under Alcan Aluminum and that line of cases.
Yes, Your Honor. That's because here, any potential fines are speculative. And so his alleged harm does not meet the imminent, the actual or imminent requirement of Article 3 standing. In order for him to face this harm, to face a harm for his shares under Article 3, it would depend on a series of events that may not or seem likely not to occur at this time for OSI Systems. So there would have to be more nominees than director positions in order for Mr. Milan to make his choice. OSI systems would have to fall out of compliance with SB 826.
It seems to me that this is now hinging on the Secretary of State's grace and not issuing a fine, but from the perspective of the shareholder, they don't know whether that grace will be given or not. They're under there's a threat of this fine, which the secretary is empowered to levy. So I guess why wouldn't that be sufficient?
Well, because Your Honor, under this, it's highly speculative, and any harm, the harm of a fine, there's no evidence that would harm the shares of Mr. Milan in OSI Systems, which is, I believe it's valued at it's a billion-dollar company. So in order for there to be a harm to Mr. Milan and to his shares, OSI Systems would have to fall out of compliance with SB 826. The Secretary of State would have to exercise her discretion to implement regulations and to implement fines. The Secretary of State would have to impose those fines upon SB 826, and those fines would somehow have to harm Mr. Milan's shares.
I thought Alcan Aluminum said any financial imposition on a corporation gives a shareholder standing. It doesn't have to affect the value of the shares. I didn't see that in Alcan Aluminum. Are you looking at some other case?
No, Your Honor, I apologize. While Alcan Aluminum did not stand for that principle, here, again, this relies on an entirely attenuated set of circumstances as more akin to the set of circumstances described in Clapper v. Amnesty International.
He alleged specifically that he changed his vote and therefore because of the law, and therefore he was not able to vote either the slate or the candidate that he would have but for the law. Would that be a sufficient allegation to provide a foundation for standing?
Well, Your Honor, it would certainly give more, it would certainly provide more allegations than what he's currently alleged in his complaint. But again, there is no, I think it would have to be, again, he would have to be able to show that any shareholder, that any nominee that he wanted was not put forward by the board was not put forward as a nominee for election. And I think he would have to also show that, yes, he would have to make some sort of specific allegations with regard to himself and to his own injury.
Is it in the record that all of the nominees that come out of the governance committee, that's the only slate available to vote? In other words, are there more nominees than slots?
Your Honor, what is in the record, it's not known for other years, but for February, for 2019, the form 10K, which we submitted as part of our supplemental excerpts, shows that there were seven nominees, and all seven nominees were elected. I see that I'm out of time, but I did want to raise one more point, but I'm happy to stop.
Go ahead.
In response to Mr. Milan's assertion that clearly SB 826 is working, or SB 826 is coercive because corporations are in compliance with SB 826, there's no evidence of that. There's no evidence of coercion. And looking specifically at OSI Systems, of the seven nominees, if every nominee was, you know, there was a spot for every nominee, the director, who was a woman, received the most votes. There's no evidence that this is because of coercion. It appears to be because of shareholder choice. And again, the corporation that...
I guess that's a fact. If it went further, that, of course, would come up in factual discovery, but I don't know at this point we can draw conclusions one way or the other.
Thank you, Your Honor. At this time, unless you have any further questions, I'll stop.
Let me just ask the panel, do you have any further questions for Ms. Haddad?
No, thank you.
No. All right. Ms. Bowden, you have rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. The court was right to point out that under Article 3, the potential fine to the corporation would be enough to give the plaintiff a shareholder standing, and the plaintiff need not wait for the consummation of the threatened injury in order to have standing and can bring a case for pre-enforcement review seeking prospective relief. And even though opposing counsel suggests that it's speculative about whether they will ever enforce the law, first I want to point out that they are enforcing the law. In fact, the Secretary of State is gathering information on compliant companies and non-compliant companies and publishing it. And that is part of our allegation that that activity is part of the coercive, that's part of the coercion that's going on here. But secondly, it's just inherent in the nature of elections that they're speculative. You can never be sure about how the election's going to come out unless you are a majority shareholder or unless you can predict the future. But I think by analogizing to political elections, we see why the speculative nature doesn't mean that voters don't have a credible fear of future enforcement. The only way to be sure that there will not be future enforcement and that the here the corporation, or if we take a political analogy, if you have to vote for a woman representative, the only way to be sure that that's not going to happen is by changing your behavior. And so that shows why there's a credible threat of injury each time, because you don't know unless you change your behavior. And that's just a feature of voting. And it would be very regressive to say that you only have standing if you're a majority shareholder, because that would mean that only those people with extreme power and capital are able to go to the courthouse. And those that are meanwhile stuck wondering if their vote is going to subject the corporation to penalty, the courthouse doors are closed to them. We've alleged a coercive pressure. We're not saying that our injury is the denial of any certain benefit. We don't want to wait for the consummation of an injury and ask for retrospective relief. We're asking for prospective relief because we believe that we are injured either way. So unless there are any further questions.
It appears not.
Thank you very much. Right.
Thank you. The case of Creighton Mellon versus Alex Padilla is submitted. I do want to thank both counsel, and particularly not only well argued, but very well briefed by both sides. And also thank the numerous amici that submitted briefs as well. And with that, we are adjourned for the morning.
Thank you. This court for this session stands adjourned.